It's a great pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with Mark Rubenstein again. As I'm sure many of you know by now, Mark and I are connecting on a weekly basis to talk about what he is writing about in his terrific weekly newsletter called Net Interest. It provides insight and analysis from the world of finance. I always learn a tremendous amount, Mark, and so I'm very grateful to you to have the opportunity to have these conversations, to go even deeper. Last Friday, you wrote about a name that, frankly, I wasn't familiar with, Lee Hawk. Tell us about that.
Well, so D Hawk, his name is D Hawk.
Oh, and, correct.
And like you, John, I wasn't familiar with him either. I've followed Visa when I was managing money at the fund. We subscribed to the Visa IPO back in 2008. His name didn't come up then. He basically is the founder of Visa. So he's still alive. He's a 92-year-old man. He lives in the state of Washington on the west coast of the United States. He retired from Visa in 1984, so way before the company went public. But he founded it back in the late 60s, early 1970s. Visa didn't exist. The credit card had been invented by Bank of America, and they back in 1958. So, and I wrote about this actually in a piece about buy now, pay later, which is the emerging new payments mechanism that allows consumers to literally buy now and pay later. So I wrote about the origins of the credit card back then. It was founded, it was launched in 1958 in California. It was a difficult thing to get started because, like any two-sided marketplace, both sides had to be of sufficient scale for it to get going. And Bank of America were adept at recruiting both merchants on the one side of the marketplace and consumers, mostly borrowers, because initially it was the credit functionality of the credit card which allowed it to gain traction. But it was very much a Bank of America thing. What they subsequently did is they licensed it for various reasons we can go into. They retained the not so much the intellectual property, but they developed some accounting infrastructure and some marketing know-how, and they licensed both the accounting and the marketing to other banks. And that's where D Hawk got involved. So he's got a very interesting history. He was born just before the Depression in March of 1929. He'd spent a number of years around consumer finance and banking, and he found himself in a bank in Seattle, and this bank wanted to take on a Bank of America license. And so he was asked to lead that charge, which he did. He was given 90 days to do it. And actually, just to maybe take a step back, the man who introduced me to D Hawk was Patrick Collison. Patrick Collison tweeted back in May in response to a question about surprises in business. He tweeted, for one thing, it's always been surprising to him that D Hawk isn't more widely recognized as a business genius. And actually, if you go to Patrick Collison's website, there's a section which he calls FAST, where he looks at examples through history, not just business, but science and other domains as well, at achievements that have been conducted in record time scale. And actually, I haven't looked recently, but I wouldn't be surprised if the development of the coronavirus vaccine is in there as well as an example of a technology that's been attained at a very, very fast pace. The first example he gives is D Hawk and the fact that he was given by his Seattle employees 90 days to get the license, the Bank of America credit card license, up and running. And he did that. He achieved that. which was remarkable. So that's basically who he is. We can go on and talk about the origins of Visa in a second, but that's basically who he is. Born in 1929. Very, very interesting backstory. He wrote a autobiography initially in 1999. A new edition was published in 2005. And we can touch upon that, John, because it's fascinating. Insights into business and leadership and all sorts of areas, not just restricted to credit cards.
Yeah, I look forward to doing that a little bit later. What's interesting to me with D-Hawk is that he really didn't have the idea for Visa on his own. It was kind of an accident of history, right? I mean, he was at a job that he wasn't particularly enjoying, and that was sort of a project he was pulled into. At a time when, you know, that system, it sounds like the Bank of America thrust into credit cards was still early on, but then at some point it became sort of unmanageable, that whole network, as it scaled. And that's where, you know, D-Hawk, it sounds like, really had the spark of the idea for Visa. So just tell us a little bit about that, how Visa actually came about and what problem it solved.
So in 1966, he launches the license for his Seattle bank, and they were then issuing credit cards to their customers as a bank that had been licensed by Bank of America. Bank of America was doing the same thing all over the country. So there were hundreds of banks that had taken a similar license. But the system fell into a degree of disrepair, because while Bank of America was offering accounting software and marketing, they weren't clearing any of the transactions that were taking place between banks. So let's say D-Hawk's own bank in Seattle issued a credit card to one of its customers, to an individual, a consumer. And that customer then went to California and made a purchase in a store that was banked by Bank of America. Actually, that's a bad example, because banked by Wells Fargo, let's say. The way it would work is the transaction is behind the scenes. Payment would then flow between those two banks, between the Seattle Bank and Wells Fargo. It wouldn't go via Bank of America. Now, at small scale, this was fine. But obviously, as the system scaled up, there were many, many, many of these bilateral flows that were taking place, and they were clogging up the system, particularly as these banks were competing with each other. And in many cases, and don't forget, back then it was paper-based, huge reams of paper would pile up in the back rooms of these banks. And so there was an element of dissatisfaction amongst the licensed banks, and they had a conference, and a proposal was made that they change the structure of the system, and that they take control of the clearing process via a new organization, that in order to ensure the degree of trust that would be required to underpin it, they take a not so much a shareholding, but they take a participation directly in that system. So he had the idea for a new type of organization. All of the banks would participate in that organization. Governance would be shared within that organization. And that organization would conduct the clearing of all of these transactions. Now, number of points here. Firstly, question number one, why would Bank of America agree to such a thing? In the current system, Bank of America were taking a very nice royalty. Actually, they were taking $25,000 flat. Don't forget, we're talking 1968, 1969 money. $25,000 flat for a license and then a royalty on all of the transactions. So question one, why would they agree to this? Question two is, ultimately, it required 3,000 banks. By the time it came together, in 1970. There were 3,000 banks that were involved in some way in this licensing process. Getting them to agree, getting all 3,000 banks to agree on any kind of structure, clearly very, very difficult. But D-Holt was able to do both of those things. Now, his background is in debating. He, at school, was a keen debater, actually an avid reader as well. You mentioned earlier, John, that he wasn't particularly happy in his previous work, and that's true. Before he emerged with this idea, with this project, he'd been involved in banking and in consumer credit and in the investment business for 16 years. And he was thoroughly miserable. He found that he couldn't really work in classical hierarchical structures. And by the mid-60s, he talked about being retired on the job. And he was he loved walking. He loved nature. He was an avid reader, as Charlie Munger would appreciate, and as all good value investors are. He was an avid reader, and he retired on the job. So basically, he took this job in Seattle on the basis that he would do his 9 to 5, and then he'd spend his weekends and his evenings reading and walking and so on. This project then came along, and it just captured his imagination. One of the reasons why it captured his imagination is because he'd been thinking anyway about organizational structure for many, many years, not seeing himself as the cog in the classical hierarchical, what he calls command and control structure. He had already thought about other innovative organizational structures inspired by nature. So he'd done a lot of reading around evolution, and around the way brains work, and anthropology and sociology. And his view was that the classical bureaucratic structure was a manifestation of the industrial age, the machine age. And this is remarkably ahead of his time, because back then people weren't talking about the knowledge economy or the information age, but he had a view that knowledge work, information work, would require a different type of organizational structure. And he wondered whether such a structure that was self-organizing, where the power was distributive, where governance was distributive, where cooperation and competition could work hand in hand. And he asked these questions, and that was the structure that he ultimately was able to convince Bank of America and those 3,000 banks to deploy. And in 1970, it was called something else. It was called NBI, but it was, to all intents and purposes, Visa. And the rest is history. This is now obviously a huge, huge company.
Right, so the organizational structure was clearly very forward-thinking and unique at the time, and actually still quite unique. If you look at the corporate world, there really aren't many entities quite like Visa. The other forward-thinking thrust, if you will, from my vantage point, and you write about this, is the idea of electronic value exchange, and not really looking at this as a credit card per se, the plastic itself, and also the idea of trust and putting that Visa logo prominently on there instead of each issuing bank logo or in addition to. Tell us about that, please.
So you're right. So from my perspective, he had two big ideas. The first big idea was around organization, and that organization was a solution to the problem of the breakdown of the licensing system rather than an operational solution. So that was point one, which we've discussed. Point two, as you've rightly raised, is this idea about what the credit card is. And actually, if you look across other industries, it's very interesting. Often the breakthroughs come when the industry in question is reframed, when an innovator asks, what is the industry I'm playing in? So, you know, there are many, many examples. Listeners will have their own examples. One that springs to mind is Uber, where the innovation was, maybe we're not in the taxi business, we're in the transportation business, or even the delivery business. And there are many, many, many such examples of this. And here's another. So previously, the credit card was just that. It was a way to achieve credit. It was a way for the consumer to borrow through a pre-approved credit line offered by the issuing bank. He wasn't a fan of credit cards. When he was recruited to the role of licensing Bank of America's credit card for his bank in Seattle, he initially told his boss, no, he didn't want to do it. He's not a fan of credit cards. He destroyed all his credit cards previously and was no great fan of consumer credit. He took the job, and subsequently, he maybe because of that was his motivation. He peeled the onion, and he came to the conclusion. He said the first primary function of the card is to identify the buyer to the seller and the seller to the buyer. And he carried on peeling the onion. The second primary function is as a guarantor of the value of data. And he carried on peeling the onion. The third primary function was the origination and transfer of data. And that's when he had the revelation. He said it was a sudden realization that credit card was a misnomer based on banking jargon, and that the card was simply a device for exchanging value. Initially he talked about monetary value, but actually in his book, which was written in 99, a long time before Bitcoin, he talked about the inherent in the infrastructure that he was noodling on was the genesis of a new form of global currency. And he says, and he even talks about nation state monopolies on the issuance and control of currency being eroded. So very, very interesting. The idea that it wasn't credit that was at the heart of the system. It was alphanumeric data. And again, we've got to remember the time. It was 1969, 1970, 1971. Computing power was primitive compared to what's available today. And yet he saw money through this different lens of it being about alphanumeric data, and therefore the power that a data network could ultimately have. And that's how he saw Visa. And you know, I didn't talk about this in the piece, but there's a very good book called Electronic Value Exchange by David Stearns. I find some of the best books are PhD theses that are then turned into books. This is one such example of that. And this book talks about the early days of Visa. And there are various chapters in there about from the technology perspective. And he wasn't a technologist. His background was as in consumer lending, not technology, but he saw technology as the means of facilitating the transfer of alphanumeric data, which for his ends was money, but could have had different ends equally.
One example you also mention is that of JCPenney and then basically issuing a Visa card directly, and the banks were up in arms about that. Tell us just a little bit about that example, because it kind of highlights some of the potential issues in the system, and how has that evolved over time in terms of not just the banks being able to issue those cards?
Yeah, it's a great point. So he tread a fairly tight line, because up until 2008, when Visa was IPO'd, it was a membership organization owned by the banks. So in the period between 1970 and 1984, when he was running it, his employers ultimately were the banks. And there was an inherent conflict. There was a conflict in that. There was a conflict in terms of whether one wanted to optimize competition between the various banks, or whether one wanted to optimize competition between Visa as a system and another system. And I'll come to your question in a second, but there was a few areas in which he had disagreements with the banks. The one you raise is one, but this the one that I'm talking about now is called Duality, and it's another. He didn't want Visa to be the monopoly or duopoly that it currently is. He doesn't use the word libertarian, but I think through some of his readings, we get a sense today that that's where his politics lay. That's where his perspective was. And he wanted to create competition. And one of the ways he thought he could do that is if banks were forced to choose which system they wanted to be a part of. So there was always the role for a competing system to be formed if banks broke away from Visa, or if new banks emerged or founded that could create their own network. Now, we can talk later. I mean, there's a few questions. I mean, I'm not going to accuse him of being naive, but there's a question about whether one can, given the ultimate network dynamics of the system, whether that makes sense. But put that to one side. So what he wanted is for banks to have to choose whether to be part of Visa or part of MasterCard, which previously was called Interchange. And he was overruled on that. And banks said, actually, no, we want to be part of both. And by being part of both, that increased the competition between the banks, but it didn't increase competition between the systems particularly, because to all intents and purposes, they were the same system with the same membership and the same ownership. So that was one area of disagreement which he lost on. The second to the question you raised, which is JCPenney. So he always had the view, and again, consistent with his politics and the idea that it should be an open platform, he was of the view that it shouldn't be a network with access exclusively to the banks, and that merchants should have direct access as well. And again, back then, the merchants were very large. The merchants actually back then were pioneers in consumer credit. A lot of they dominated the charge card, the credit card industry back in the 50s and 60s. When Bank of America launched its credit card in 58, it was competing with store cards. And he, in 1979, invited JCPenney to be a direct participant in the Visa network. As you say, the banks were up in arms. They were very upset about this. They wanted to control the merchant relationships, and they didn't want to be disintermediated in this network by the merchants directly. D-Hoc lost, but he was very, very upset about it. And he said, at the time, many bankers refused to realize that many large retailers can do everything a bank can do, and often better. Now, he said this in 1979. I find this very, very timely, because right now there is a battle underway between banks and financial services companies and large technology companies, even retailers, no longer JCPenney, but such as retail platforms such as Shopify. And so it's very poignant. It was very interesting. And I think one of the trends in fintech today is this idea of embedded finance, embedding payments within the merchant experience, within the consumer experience at the merchant. And this was something that he conceived of 40, 50 years ago, quite remarkably so. So that was JCPenney. It didn't happen at the time. And then several years later, he ended up leaving Visa.
And obviously, the system has evolved in other ways as well over time. I think one of the things that I've read about elsewhere is also the rise of kind of these merchant acquirers like Global Payments, where the banks basically outsourced a lot of the merchant acquiring. So there's a lot of interesting players in this ecosystem, which brings me kind of to that point that D-Hoc has made, I guess, fairly recently about the structure not really being something to emulate, which surprised me a little bit, frankly, because I think it's a quite an innovative structure.
Yeah, that's right. That is right. He said when he wrote, he said by the standards of what a visa ought to be, it would be a lie to deny a sense of failure. In spite of my pride in all that Visa demonstrated about the power of his concept of organization, which he calls chaotic. So just as an aside here, he coined this term chaotic, chaos and order, to reflect a type of organization which is capable of performing in an environment of complexity. Very, very influenced by these ideas of complexity coming out of the Santa Fe Institute. And chaotic was the term not widely used, didn't really catch on, but very interesting term that he coined. So he said, in spite of the pride in all that Visa demonstrated about the power of the chaotic concept of organization, and all the things the company accomplished, he doesn't believe it's a model to emulate. It's one to study, learn from, and improve upon. And actually, I never found a quote about, I'd be very, very interested to know, I'm sure somebody out there who's listening to this might know, but I'd be very, very interested to know what he thought about Visa IPOing back in 2008, what he thought about that. Because one of his core tenets was this idea about it being owned, about ownership being in the form of irrevocable right of participation, the membership structure. So it'll be very interesting to know how he thinks about that, particularly now that Visa, since IPOing, inevitably has extracted more pricing power. It's now a for-profit organization, hence its phenomenal margins. 68% EBITDA margins, and pricing power. So he was a bit skeptical about that. We've spoken about the idea that merchants should be allowed direct access. We've spoken about the fact that he wants and wanted alternative networks to emerge. Although, like I say, I'm not sure how credible that was given the network economics at play. And also, to your point, he doesn't really affect Visa. Visa doesn't make money on interest income the way the issuing banks do. But given the rates of interest in excess of 18%, still a lot of money is made from interest income by issuing banks. And when we look at the ecosystem, whether it's merchant acquirers, whether it's the network itself, whether it's the ecosystem is now very, very complex. When we look at all of that together, still an awful lot of money is made from interest income. And he personally, as we've discussed, wasn't a fan of credit, of consumer credit and credit cards. And he is a bit anxious to the degree to which the economics are still so tipped toward that as the source of profitability.
I find that very interesting because, you know, the system has kind of gravitated toward maximization of profits for the banks, and it happens to be more on the credit side, perhaps, than on the payment side even. And maybe DeHaak would have liked to kind of separate the payment side a bit more from the credit side, which is kind of what American Express was doing. And before they really amped up the credit side of things, they were pretty much a payment product where you had to pay off your balance at the end of each month. So one thing I wonder, Mark, and maybe you have a perspective on this, is whether that provision of credit and the focus on the credit side has actually slowed innovation because they have their cash cow and they're not really forced to be at the forefront of payments innovation.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. That is an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. That's why the banks aren't at the forefront of payments innovation. I suspect as well, and again, he was slightly ahead of his time here, realizing that payments, I think, increasingly, and this is a theme in fintechs, that payments are becoming almost the anchor. Historically, the anchor product was the checking account. and payments was a feature of the checking account. Increasingly, payments are becoming the anchor product. Payments, and we can see this, for example, in China. I mean, Ant now has the various problems associated with Ant, various regulatory problems and questions around Jack Ma and so on and so forth. But the fact remains, Ant, Alipay, was a phenomenal innovation that worked in China where payments evolved very, very differently to Europe and the US. But Ant ultimately became a full-scale financial company offering, not necessarily on its own balance sheet, which is one of the issues it's currently facing, but offering many of the same products that, say, JP Morgan would offer. But it led with payments. It led with payments rather than leading with the checking account. So that's a slightly different perspective, and that could be now the way we're going, and it's not a perspective that banks, to your point, they are protecting the deposit franchises and they've got other franchises. Actually, it's a point Dehot raises. He says, actually, that it breaks down, it helps to break down that his innovation helped already to break down some of the barriers within banks. So prior to Visa, the credit department of bank was very, very distinct from the deposit part of the bank. But then debit cards kind of brought payments and the deposit account closer together. Credit cards had brought payments and credit closer together. So there's a kind of convergence, and possibly it's converging on payments as the anchor product.
Yeah, and I think ultimately, and you make this point, is the story of payments is really an incremental one. And, you know, Visa has its role, a huge role, and it's not going anywhere, as you say, but there's plenty of scope for contenders in the future. And actually, at the outset of your article, you talk about JD Sports, and anyone who might have done some shopping there in the UK over the holidays would have noticed a whole multitude of icons when it comes to paying. So it seems like we're really quite early in figuring out where this is all going to go.
Yes, but yeah, I completely, that's exactly right. I think, and it's difficult to know. It's difficult to, I think what makes it very, very hard to forecast the end game is that there are many different dimensions to it. There's electronic versus cash. So Visa will say our number one competitor is cash. And that's true. Cash is still very important means of payment, and Visa competes with that. So, and certainly COVID has accelerated that shift away from cash towards electronic payments. But that's just one dimension. Other dimensions might be credit versus debit. We've been speaking a little bit about that, given Dehok's views of credit. You mentioned Amex. Amex is a closed network, and as is Alipay. So, and there are questions around whether the winner will be a closed network, not the winner, but whether the emergence of new closed networks, and a firm which is IPOing this week in the US, Klarna, which is big Swedish payments company, they offer closed networks. And then crypto as well, and whether the degree to which that can disintermediate payments, whether it's regulated versus unregulated, whether we talked about embedded finance and how much of this happens within the big tech companies and the merchants. And therefore, another dimension is the degree to which it happens within financial services versus outside financial services. Certainly when Apple Pay was launched many, many years ago, and Apple Card more recently, satisfied some people within financial services that it would happen within financial services, because partnerships there were agreed between Apple and JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. But these are all open questions, and therefore there's a lot of venture capital funding being thrown at this. There's a lot of market cap resting on it, but where it all ends up, particularly given, you know, one of the books I read over the holidays was Kings of Crypto, about Coinbase, which is about to IPO. Well, they've filed for an IPO sometime for this year. And what I hadn't realized is when this company was launched, it was launched as a Bitcoin payment company. And as a merchant acquirer, they went out acquiring merchants to accept Bitcoin. They actually signed up some merchants, but coming back to this issue of the two-sided marketplace, there weren't enough consumers on the other side who wanted to pay in Bitcoin. And they pivoted away from it being a payments company to being a brokerage company to allow the trading of Bitcoin as an asset class. So there were questions. So there were questions there as well, whether that can also become a more effective, more efficient payments mechanism. So lots and lots of questions, and it's going to be a very exciting year or several years to see how it all pans out.
Indeed, one thing I find refreshing is that you have someone like Patrick Collison, who is clearly an innovator in this space. With Stripe, who seems to be very aware of the history of payments. And that I find that encouraging. And also I find it potentially a sign that Stripe may have a leg up here, because having that kind of historical perspective versus just, not really looking back, I'd say could give them a competitive advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly, I think right now in financial services, Stripe is everybody's favorite private company. I completely agree with you.
Terrific. Well, Mark, thank you so much. This was a real pleasure. Always enjoy your insights and your wisdom in this space.
Thank you, John. Thanks.
Take care for now.